R&B Media Philadelphia. It's old school 100.3. Good morning. Court Radio is now in session. Call 215-263-1003. When you've got legal questions, we've got the answers. This is Court Radio. And now, here's your host, Dean Weitzman.
Good morning and welcome to Philadelphia's new radio station, Old School 100.3. That's right, I'm Dean Weitzman, and you've made it to the right place. This is Court Radio, same place we've always been, Sunday mornings at 7 a.m., though the station does have a new focus, Old School 100.3. Welcome. Welcome, David.
Good morning.
That's the voice of my co-host, the one and only David M. Rappaport.
Good morning. Good morning.
Good
old
morning.
School.
Old
We're going school. Old school.
It's kind of, I guess it's, you know, like Stevie Wonder and Michael Jackson and all that old school, old head stuff.
I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, not our time.
Well, sort of.
Yeah.
Beginning of our time.
No, I don't know about that. You were like a boys to men guy, you know?
No, I wasn't. I never was a boys to men. Ugh, God, how dare you?
Is that slander?
I would have taken Stevie Wonder any day over boys to men.
I've actually, yes, I actually did grow up with Stevie Wonder. But anyway.
Boys to men.
Just my little joke. Folks, yeah. Welcome to Court Radio. This is the place where you get to ask your legal questions. Still one at a time. Don't ask that second question. We'll have to give you the old claw. And speaking of old school, and that's it. You know, we talk about legal issues here in the Philadelphia landscape. If you want to reach us, you can call us at 215-263-1003. That's correct. 215. The number hasn't changed, even though we're old school, 100.3.
It's not like H-O-4-3. Remember they used to do the letters?
I get like a nickel in my piggy bank every time I say old school 100.3. Bing! You know, that comes right from Tom Joyner's bank account into my bank account.
Old school, old school, old school.
Thank you, Tommy. Okay, so we talk about legal issues here, right, David?
Yes, we do.
Because we're lawyers.
We are. And that's...
We sometimes forget that.
Thanks.
Sometimes on Sunday mornings, we might forget that, but we are lawyers.
We're actually lawyers. Yes. We actually go to court and do those things.
Yeah, well, I hail from Temple University.
So do I.
I'm one of the Diamonds.
Yes. I went. Did you go undergrad as well?
I did.
Yeah, so did I.
Undergrad. Well, I was a little more. It took me a little longer to learn.
You took the long way, huh?
Yeah.
All right.
But it sunk in even deeper. yes, I was. Undergrad as a psych major.
Mm-hmm.
That's for the all those majors you didn't know what you wanted to do, and you couldn't be undeclared any longer. You became a psych major.
Basket weaving, I know.
And then off to the law school.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes, sirree, Bob. I was in North Philly for quite some time.
Yeah, so was I. Well, I actually commute. I was one of the commuting.
Back then, you were allowed to commute.
Yeah, until...
Back when Stevie Wonder played.
Yeah.
And now, everybody's like living on campus.
Yeah, I actually lived all over the city during that time.
215-263-1003. Let's give a few things about what's going on in and around town. There was a fake nurses. It popped up at St. Christopher's Hospital. Ashley Delvale, 24, of Feltonville, and she molested a child.
Yeah, you really got to be desperate to do this kind of thing. I mean, there's... just boggles my mind. And how do you not get caught? How are you a fake nurse in today's world?
Well,
what do you print out a certificate?
If you asked Ashley, she failed. So, you know, I guess the answer to your question is it's not all that easy. I'd say it's a sickness. That's I'm going to go with the sickness part of the criminal scheme of things. And I'd say that she needs a lot of help.
She touched one of the children inappropriately and took the weight of another one.
Okay.
And that doesn't sound like a crime to me, but the first one does.
Took the weight. Wow, she was really playing nurse.
Right, she actually took the weight of one.
215-263-1003. Also in the news is Trayvon Martin's family. They settled the wrongful death suit against the homeowners association,
neighborhood watch thing.
The neighborhood watch, yep, the community association George Zimmerman, right, there you go, thanks, I'm having a trouble this morning, not enough caffeine. George Zimmerman was working on behalf of,
right,
and it settled for over $1 million. They won't say how much. I guess it's, nowadays it's everything is confidential. Settled a case this week, David.
You did.
I did settle a case this week. It is confidential.
How dare you? Should never agree to that.
Yeah. Well, this was a really, I threatened to, talk about it every Sunday for the next 300 years
and they
on
didn't
Core
care.
Radio. Oh, no. They cared, but... One of the consequences was that there was a confidentiality, which is not uncommon on bigger settlements these days. So it was a big settlement for my client, and he's down in Florida, as a matter of fact, and I still haven't talked to him. I wonder where he is. 215-263-1003. I hope not. I left him a message. All right, well, maybe he'll call me Monday. We had that $1.7 million whistleblower verdict.
Yeah, but it's they're not paying.
Not paying.
Not paying. They're trying to get it overturned.
Yeah, that's what they do.
Yeah, I mean to others that might sound like a surprising story. It's kind of what always happens. It doesn't sound surprising to me. Whenever you go to trial and you win resoundingly, there's always an appeal. If there can be, and there usually can be for some reason, whether it's good or not.
Yeah, it doesn't mean the appeal is going to work.
No.
And most appeals don't work. But they're entitled to their right to appeal. And if there's any basis at all, they usually take advantage of that. And that helps drive down the award. So a $1.7 million jury award doesn't mean that the victim of that crime, or in this case, the whistleblower, is actually going to get $1.7 million because... as a result of the threat of appeal, the possibility that it may be overturned, however remote, it's going to cause that number to tick down somewhat.
Yep.
And so the defendants know that. They take advantage of that. And, maybe it'll settle for $1.2 million. Folks, if you have a matter that you think is a significant matter that should be heard by the courts, you can give us a call during the week. 24/7 at 215-227-2727.
I have to comment on this last story because...
prostitution?
Yeah, well...
Is it?
Listen to the story. I'll give
is
you
it
the
prostitution?
Yeah, of course.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, we usually end with a prostitution story.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. What would a Sunday morning be without a little bit of a prostitution story?
But the facts of this are very interesting. It's in Homestead, okay? A Homestead woman was charged with prostitution. Now, the Homestead police officer, get this, Ronald D. Pellegrin, 48-year-old guy, he asked for, okay, that's the key here, asked for and received permission to conduct a sting operation against this woman, okay? Then he, in the sting operation, gets her into a room. And they talk about exchanging money for sexual favors, okay, all that stuff. Probably at that point there could have been an arrest. But instead he actually gets her to perform.
The actual act.
The act. And then they get arrested. She gets arrested.
As well as him.
No. Not only that's the key to the story. No, they said he didn't do anything wrong. I mean, what a great job. He probably liked this woman. He said, hey, I want to conduct a sting operation on her. I think she might be a prostitute. They give him permission. Then he goes, gets some sex from her, and then arrests her. And he keeps doing that. Boy, he could get kind of a date a week. Right? A date a week and an arrest. I mean, what a great job, huh?
The new FOP matchmaking.
Yeah. I don't understand it. Now, he had nothing. They didn't admonish him at all. They said he did nothing wrong.
Yeah, well, I think our listeners might have a different view on that. 215-263-1003. Let's talk to Mike from North Philly. Good morning, Mike, and welcome to Court Radio.
Morning. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing well, thanks. What's your question?
Okay, my question is, like, a little over a year ago, my father made an agreement to sell his house to this guy on time. And the guy said his money was held up for about 6 months, so he agreed to pay, like, $2,000 a month for 6 months. And if it, at the end of that 6 months, he didn't pay the whole, you know, come up with the rest of it, he would forfeit what, you know, what the original price is. But meanwhile, he done cut the place into apartments and rented it out and everything, you know. And I'm trying to see, I'm trying to see that by my father giving him a little more time, did he break the agreement? Or do we have a case to get his house back?
Okay, good question. Well,
was it in writing?
Yeah, the original agreement was in writing, I assume.
Yes.
Okay, and the modification that your dad made, the generous modification, was that in writing?
What you mean, the modification?
Well, when your father extended it, gave him some more time, as you put it.
No, he didn't get it.
Okay. Well, here's the answer. The answer is that, yes, it might be deemed a new modification of the agreement. It may be that it gave the owner or the prospective owner some additional rights, but it probably doesn't throw the entire baby out with the bathwater. So the agreement's still good, and if, in fact, the guy never pays the money, I think there's an argument, a strong argument, that he's in violation of the agreement and he loses.
Just stop paying.
Well, then...
when they've written it.
Yeah. Well, then it's time for Dad to hire a lawyer and take some action to get the guy off of the property and out of getting the rents from the tenants. Your dad has rights under the agreement. I don't think those rights were dismissed by his extension, but I don't think it's something he should be doing on his own. I think it's time to retain the services of an attorney.
Yeah, I think so, too.
All right. Have a great day. Thanks for calling the Court Radio. You can always reach us all week long at 215-227-2727.
227-2727. Thank you very much.
All right. Be well. All right, David, off to our hot-button topic.
Okay.
I watched a film this week that really was eye-opening. It was amazing to me, and I kind of knew that this was the case, but I don't know. It just brought it all together in one place. It's called The House I Live In. The House I Live In. And it's a movie. Well, we have a little clip. Let's just play this clip. It'll give you some sense of what this is about.
Drugs is a monster. The killing, the stealing, the people being destroyed. It's devastating. What happened to my son with drugs, I would love to change that.
America's public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse. In order to fight and defeat this enemy, it is necessary to wage a new all-out offensive.
You know, in any war, you've got to have an enemy. And when you think about the impact, particularly on poor people of color, there are more African Americans under correctional control today in prison or jail, on probation or parole, than were enslaved in 1850, a decade before the Civil War began.
You have to understand the war on drugs has never been about drugs.
Somebody down the road said, we're going to fight a war against illicit drugs because drugs are bad. Okay, there's no argument there. But think about where we are 30 years later. You know, if you look at all the money spent on drug enforcement, on prisons, on probation officers, judges, narcotics agents, on interdiction, and everything else that has expanded due to the war on drugs, it gratifies us and makes us feel like we're tough on crime. But to what end? We are the jailingest country on the planet, beyond Saudi Arabia, China, or Russia. Nobody jails their population at the rate that we do. And yet, drugs are purer than ever before. They're more available. There are younger and younger kids willing to sell them. It'd be one thing if it was draconian and it worked, but it's draconian and it doesn't work, and it just leads to more.
Well, that kind of sets the stage.
It does. It gives a good synopsis of what that film is about.
And we're joined on the line here in studio with the film's director, the one and only Eugene Jarecki. Good morning, Eugene.
Good morning. How are you doing, Dave?
I'm doing well,
creator,
thanks.
Creator and director.
Yeah, creator, director, the man about town. And he and Gene won the Grand Jury Prize at the Sundance Film Festival for The House I Live In, as well you should. I thought it was a wonderful film, and I'm really happy you joined us today for a discussion about it. How are you today, Eugene?
I'm doing very well. I was just in Philadelphia yesterday.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I saw that. There was a report that there was somebody from out of town in Philly. And
it was me.
There was four cheesesteaks missing, too.
There were two. My buddy and I, the guy working with me, we both got one.
All right. So, Eugene, I really related very deeply to this film. I too, grew up with a Nanny Jeter kind of a person. And I'm not going to, you know, we won't get too much. I mean, the folks will have to watch it. Tell us where they can see it, and then we're going to get into a discussion. But where can people see The House I Live In?
Well, it's actually coming out tomorrow night on PBS all over the country. So at 10 p.m. Monday night, April 8th, which is tomorrow, it's going to be out in on PBS stations all over the country at 10 o'clock.
All right. Well, our PBS station, Channel 12, WHYY, I'm sure we'll be showing it.
If people can't make that, they can also see it on online at iTunes. You can download it, a lot of other VOD sites.
There you go. I think it's also on demand on the cable stations.
Yes, it is.
So the idea behind the film, where did it come from?
Well, it came really from my own personal experience, and that's not that I have personal drug experience or I have personal drug war experience. I'm lucky enough to be one of those sort of comfortable white Americans for whom the drug war is a really distant reality that affects, you know, other people. But it affected me in a very interesting way because I grew up as the child of Jewish immigrants who had come fleeing the Holocaust. My father's family fled for their lives in 1939 from Hitler in Germany, and my mother's family had fled from Tsarist Russia about 40 years earlier. And so all of the children in my family, we all knew from day one, you know, that we were children of flight, and that we had a special knowledge of persecution and of suffering, of prejudice. And so coming to America, we also understood that we were to see in the African-American story in America a sister struggle to the Jewish struggle in Europe. And so from day one, I had a very strong sensitivity, both, I think, natural to myself, but also conditioned into me by my parents, to see black people as really brothers in a struggle. And that meant that as I grew up in the early 1970s, the civil rights movement meant a great deal to me, and I expected tremendous gains for black America after so much life and toil and effort had been expended. And I began to see quite quickly that young black people who were my friends growing up, we were all kind of cheek by jowl going through life together, we were not having the same experiences. We were not encountering the same opportunities, and they were encountering obstacles that I wasn't. And I wondered, what were these obstacles to black progress? And over the decades, the most clear culprit of what was behind the undermining of black America was the war on drugs, which had been declared in 1971 when I was two.
You know, Eugene, since 1971, the war on drugs cost $1 trillion, with a T, dollars. We've had 45 million arrests, and drug use has remained unfettered.
Yeah.
Why?
It's a record of complete failure.
But
there's nothing
why?
About it that has succeeded. Why? Well, I think the reason that it failed is very obvious. Drug abuse is a health matter. It was an accident of history, a completely wrongheaded hysteria that this country got into to have ever dealt with it as a crime in the first place. And the embarrassing part about this, most of all, I mean, just to put aside the incredible death toll and toll on communities and toll on families that we've unleashed here by ignoring an addiction, right? The country has an addiction, severe levels of addiction, and they've gone unchecked for 40 years, undealt with, untreated. So to put that aside, the most astonishing part is we already did this once in our history. We did this with Prohibition, and it blew up in our face. It was a disaster. And so we somehow decided, you know, 45 years later, to absolutely repeat the mistake of Prohibition.
The question,
it's a crazy idea.
You couldn't be more correct. And I just wonder, why is it been intransigent for 45 years?
Oh,
why? All right, because you answered another question. But why is it that we can't get rid of it? I mean, how long did Prohibition last?
Yeah, I mean, I think what happens with these things, look, we had racist drug laws in America, and there's no question our drug laws have a racist impact. That's in the numbers. It's not deniable. We've had racist drug laws, though, going back to the 1800s. The first laws on the books that were racist that had drugs to do with them were opium laws that we used actually as just thinly veiled laws that persecuted Chinese people. And the idea was Chinese people are coming into California. We want to make it hard for them to get American jobs and threaten the job market. So we can't pass a law that says it's illegal to be Chinese. But we can pass a law saying that something the Chinese do is something we're going to take renewed police interest in. So all of a sudden you find drug laws coming on the books throughout time that often are just thinly veiled laws of racial control. But that's fine. But it's only in 1971 that Richard Nixon changes this, and he takes this racist history, and now he declares a war on drugs. Well, when you declare a war, something new and different happens. And what happened here is you unleash the dogs of war. And we know all too well from Iraq and Afghanistan and beyond that these wars become businesses, and they become big business not only for corporations, but for an unholy alliance, an industrial complex, as it were, between corporations and the politicians that serve them. And yes, I say serve them, because the politicians in this country have as a primary motivation gathering the money they need to run for office. And that money does not come in any significant way from you and me. It comes from major donors, whether that's corporations, unions, etc. So politicians in this country who work in areas, and that's everywhere, where the prison industrial system is rampant, they know very well that they need to keep those people happy. And they do that by passing laws that make things that didn't used to be crimes into crimes, and crimes that now get higher and higher, longer and longer sentences. Why? Because they know they've got to keep people moving through the system, occupying those beds in the jails, so that a whole range of profiteers can profit from their being in the jails. It's a very simple system of feeding people in and getting money out.
The bottom line, the answer to my question, I guess, is, cutting right to the chase, is cash. Cash is why this system has...
Cash and influence. You know, politicians, I think there's some politicians who are really trying to strike it rich, but you don't usually strike it particularly rich in office. What politicians do, their part of the equation is power is an aphrodisiac, as we know, but these guys love to feel, I'm a powerful, important congressman, I'm a powerful, important senator, and maybe I'll be governor, maybe I'll be president. So they're on a track that's perhaps less about directly about money and more directly about, because they got more money than they need to eat, right? So it's more just, I want to be a big, important man. I want to be a big, considered part of the society. So I think what happens is the corporations enable that narcissism. And in exchange for that, the corporations get the congressperson going to work in the morning and writing a new mandatory minimum law into a bill that could be about, you know, fixing up a public park. All of a sudden, it's got a mandatory minimum loaded into it about some drug thing. And that is going to put more people in jail that month, that year, so that that set of corporate sponsors that politician has will be happy.
Yeah.
And they will give him more money.
One of the things that I was mentioned in the film that you brought up that I thought was amazing to me is that every other country, correct me if I'm wrong, but in every other country, there is a focus more on rehabilitation or addressing the addictive problem. And the public actually supports that overwhelmingly as compared to America.
Yeah. Look, countries vary around the world. There's no question America has the most draconian drug laws of all Western nations, and we have the highest levels of demand. In other words, we're the greatest evidence of failure. We're as tough as hell, and it doesn't do anything.
Right.
Now, at the same time, the other countries have as one real role model to look to, Portugal. Portugal is the leading country in the world in dealing with its drug problem. And they did something brilliant. 10 years ago, Portugal decriminalized, i.e., they legalized the possession of all drugs across the board. Basically, if you get caught with any amount of drugs or whatever, it's almost like a traffic fine. They found a way to decriminalize it, so it's no longer a criminal offense, to possess drugs all across the board up to a certain level. If you get to a certain level, meaning a certain quantity, and they find you with a really substantial quantity, that suggests you're a dealer. They have different laws for that try to prevent dealership and deter that as a public scourge.
Right.
But at the everyday user level, which is most of who get incarcerated in America, for example, they legalized that. Now, what happened with that was fascinating. Every single leading indicator in Portugal was a stunning success. Drug use rates went down, among the young especially. HIV rates went down. Violence associated with drugs went down. And, of course, the workload of the criminal justice system in Portugal for all of that went way down. And that represented a huge economic savings for Portugal, which needed it, just as we do. And they took just a small portion of that savings and instituted the most robust treatment system in the world, because treatment is far cheaper as a way of dealing with these issues than the ridiculous waste of the war on drugs.
Right. Yeah, so, speaking of the ridiculous, yeah. With only 5% of the world's population, the United States currently houses 25% of the world's prison population.
Yeah, we are the world's leading jailer. People should know that. There's no country on earth that jails as high a percentage of its people as we do, and there's no country on earth actually that jails as many people just in hard numbers as we do. We have 2.3 million behind bars. That's a 700% increase in the prison population since the war on drugs started.
Right. So, 700% increase in the last 45 years, and you wonder who's making the dough from that. Who's making the dough? And
well,
a lot of that is privatized.
It's big, bad, corrupt interests, and it's everyday people who aren't big or bad or corrupt. So the complicated thing here is that the prison industrial system has become a way of life in America. It's one of those, just in the same way that we know that military contractors are actually getting rich from the killing of foreign people in these wars and the death of American soldiers in these wars that we're running. Just as we know that that's part of the corrupt, terrible picture of America, but we also know that many of the everyday soldiers are just some kid who got out of high school who didn't know any better or didn't have another option because there aren't a lot of jobs. He's not a bad person. He's an everyday person like you or me, caught in a machine he didn't design.
Right.
The same is true in the prison industrial sector. The cops, the jailers, well, these people aren't trying to do ill. They're actually trying to do a job which once upon a time sounded like it was in the public service. It's just that it's been so warped from the top down, where it rots from the top, that we have a policy driven by money and political greed that filters down and creates a free-for-all out in the streets. So take cops, for example. I traveled around with cops in several states in the film, in their patrol cars, in the movie. And cop after cop will tell you that they don't think what they're doing is working. But yet they do it every day, every night of their lives, on orders. And what they do is rack up cheap, petty drug arrests. David Simon, who created The Wire, is in the film.
Yeah.
And he describes how a cop sitting in his patrol car is incentivized to rack up cheap, petty, nonviolent drug arrests, because it's much harder and dirtier and messier to go pursue an actual violent crime like a rape, a robbery, or a murder. Why not just sit in your car and wait to be able to jack people up against the side of a liquor store?
Sure.
How does it end, Eugene? And before you answer that, I got to give a little station break here. I got to give the number. I want you to stand by on the line, and we're going to come right back to you after the break. Folks, if you're listening, we're talking to Eugene Jarecki, who is the producer, the creator, the director, I should say, of The House I Live In. It's probably going to be broadcast tomorrow night on Channel 12, WHYY. Our PBS station, PBS stations near you. It's also available on demand. It's in many different video locations on the web. Check it out, The House I Live In. It will change your life on how you view the war on drugs. Anybody who's got half a brain really has to scratch your head and wonder, what are we doing as a people? What are we doing as our community, the global community of America? We'll be right back with Eugene after these breaks. If you've been injured in an automobile accident, you know what matters. Being able to afford medical care, providing for your family while you're out of work, knowing your rights and getting just compensation. These things matter. That's why your attorney matters. I'm Dean Weitzman from My Philly Lawyer. If you've been injured in an auto or truck-related accident, My Philly Lawyer will fight for you. Call 215-227-2727. My Philly Lawyer, when winning matters most.
If you've been injured, the road to recovery can seem long. At United Therapy Centers, we're here to help. Call us 877-510-7764. With leading-edge technology and our team approach, we provide the highest level of patient care with a pain management program developed just for you. If you've been injured, we can help. Call United Therapy Centers toll-free 877-510-7764. United Therapy Centers, get on the road to recovery.
Are you in a financial legal squeeze? Unable to work because of an accident with your legal case still not settled? Lawsuit Funding Solutions can help you pay the bills while you wait if you have to. It can take time for a lawsuit to settle. Lawsuit Funding Solutions is here to help you get back on track. And you won't owe them a thing if your case doesn't settle or you don't receive a judgment. Get out of the squeeze today. Call 877-697-7352.
If you've been injured on the job and are entitled to workers' comp, you need someone fighting for you from the start. Call Jeffrey Gross, attorney at law. Don't rely on your employer or insurance company to get it right. Call 215-512-1500. If you're entitled to workers' comp or it's being challenged, Jeffrey Gross can help get the money you deserve, and he won't get paid unless you get paid. Call 215-512-1500. Jeffrey Gross, attorney at law, representing Pennsylvania's injured workers for more than 20 years.
Need more legal answers? Here's more Court Radio with your host, Dean Weitzman, on Old School 100.3.
Yeah. We're back. Hey, I'm Dean Weitzman, and this is Court Radio. That's correct, where we tackle the tough legal issues of the day. Well, today we're talking with Eugene Jarecki, the award-winning director of the dramatic movie that recently won a grand jury prize for documentaries at the Sundance Film Festival, and it's now being played across the country on PBS tomorrow night at 10 p.m. You can check out The House I Live In, and if you miss it, you can pick it up on demand and in other locations on the big World Wide Web. Folks, if you're listening to Court Radio this morning and you got a question about the war on drugs, you can give us a call and talk to Eugene directly or David and I at 215-263-1003. Yes, all right.
Yeah.
Totally mixed that up.
Yeah, there's a good number for you.
Yeah. All right, come on. Let's talk to T-Love from Collingdale, Pennsylvania. Good morning, T-Love, and welcome to Court Radio.
Hey, good morning. Good morning. I was just listening to the young gentleman there and talking about the drugs. I just wanted to add that, you know, drugs has always been a problem in America since the 1800s, but it was allowed to fester in the black community. In fact, it was encouraged to fester in the black community as a way to keep us racially divided and held down. You know, it didn't become a war on drugs until it affected the white communities and more started to trickle out. You know, you couldn't get police officers to police drugs in the black community. They wanted it in the black community. This is how they held us down and kept things, you know, give it to them. Let them do it. You know, once it started to trickle over, then it became a war on drugs, you know, particularly with the crack epidemic.
Yeah, well,
that
you know what? You bring up a great point, T-Love, and I have to question that. I mean, you've got this the conspiracy theory, you know, drugs were introduced or allowed to perpetuate in the black community to keep the black person down. And the question is, obviously, drug use and drug abuse deals with addiction. And a question is, why is addiction so? And it's not something that really the film touches on. And I don't want to put you on the spot, Eugene, but it seems like addiction is a cottage industry in America.
But understand this. I mean, first of all, most of what the gentleman said is not really a conspiracy theory anymore. I mean, it's known that the U.S. government, again, during the Iran-Contra period, was actually constructing a situation that was bringing drugs in an unchecked way into the inner cities. It goes to the question of motivation to try to figure out, was that a way of creating a rationale for the decades of harassment we've now seen? That doesn't need to be proved. You can really just notice that, you know, take it this way. I grew up thinking that crack was a black drug, because if you watch TV for the last 40 years, you would think that crack users in the majority are black. Well, it turns out the majority of crack users are and always have been white. I never would have imagined that from the press. Why? Because black people are 14% of the country, and it turns out they're only 14% of the crack users. The majority of crack users, more than 51%, are white. Now, I say this because to understand the racism in this, you have to see it from the way a drug dealer, a young person, 15, 16 years of age, who isn't a drug dealer, but they're called that. They're just some minion working for a bigger person. And why is it that they get picked up with drugs on them and I don't, for example? Because I live in a comfortable white neighborhood, and there aren't police dispatched to my neighborhood to harass people. That is what cops are told to do in black neighborhoods. Now, take that one step further. If I'm a white person, I live in a comfortable neighborhood as I do. Not only if I want a cop, I call them, they're there in a heartbeat. If I don't, if I'm not looking for a cop, I'm definitely not going to see one. The opposite is true as in inner cities. In inner cities, you're swarmed with cops, sort of except when you need them. Now, the next step happens is I get brought into court. Well, when I go to court and I'm a young black person, I've already been selected more because I'm black. Now I get into the court and I invariably, because black people have historically been poorer, I don't have access to the same lawyer that person doesn't have access to the same lawyer that I, a comfortable white American, does. So now he's got the deck stacked against him because he doesn't get the best lawyer. Then he finds that the laws are written in a way that's totally slanted. The crack, for example, has been punished historically 100 times more severely than powder. So if I'm walking down the street with crack cocaine, and I've got 5 grams of it, and another person's walking down the street with powder cocaine, they need 500 grams of powder just to get the same penalty that I'm going to get. Mm. And invariably, if they're a white person, they're far less likely to get stopped. So I walk into the courtroom now, and the laws are stacked 100-1 against me. And so this continues all the way down through sentencing and how people use bias and all that. So I think one way or another, to think that it's a conspiracy and to think, therefore, that somebody is planning all this in articulate wording is unnecessary. The machine has had a conspiratorially destructive impact on black America. And worst of all, Congress has known it for 40 years. They've been told it decade after decade by experts, and they sit there and say, sorry, we're not going to change it. Why? Because it ain't broke, so they don't fix it. They must want it the way that they see it, because otherwise they would change it.
Well, that brings up an interesting point, Eugene. It ain't broke, so don't fix it. Well, I question that statement, because I wonder how long can the system continue to incarcerate, house, and destroy families, neighborhoods, communities, and build prisons? How long can that continue to go on at its current pace?
Well, make no mistake, I don't agree that it ain't broke, so don't fix it. I'm just telling you, for the individual politician who's short-sightedly thinking about their next election and raising the money for the short-term things that this whole term-limited society does, where all we seem to think about is something 2 or 3 or 4 years out, for them, it ain't broke, don't fix it. For those of us who see it for real, we've wasted $1 trillion in 40 years, and we are failing ourselves and in the eyes of the world. We're ravaging our own communities. We're robbing ourselves of precious resources, let alone what we're doing to orphan children, shatter families, etc. So I don't believe it's sustainable at all, and I think it's becoming clear, I think, to the public that this disaster will not continue. Public opinion generally has been turning over several years now against the drug war, and you've seen major decisions. For example, on Election Day, there were 3 major victories against the drug war. In Colorado and Washington, marijuana was legalized across the board, not just medical, but just marijuana. That's a major development in those 2 states. And in California, on the same day, an amazing move was made. The California voters, 68% voted for Prop 36. Prop 36 changed the 3 strikes law in California in the following way. Prior to Election Day, you would go to jail for the rest of your life in California for a 3rd strike, even if that strike was petty or nonviolent. So like stealing a slice of pizza got one guy a life sentence in the state of California, for example. That is so insane that thankfully the California voters voted to say that's insane, and they instead made it so that to go to jail for the rest of your life, even if anyone agrees with that, but to go to jail for the rest of your life, you need to have committed a serious or violent crime as your 3rd strike. Well, that's a step toward real justice, and it will save the state of California $100 million a year right off the bat. So tell that to state governments across the country that are having such budgetary problems. And I think you've got the beginnings now of a movement that is taking shape. I see it in other states where drug policy is going to be changing in this country. And the question now is how? How do we change it to actually reflect not just greater fairness and greater justice, but how do we rewind back to the real truth of the matter, which is that drug is a public health matter and should never have been a criminal matter. And if we followed the example of Portugal, we'd see the same kind of success they see.
The war on drugs, when it was initiated by Richard Nixon in 1971, two-thirds of that budget on the war on drugs at that time went toward treatment. Two-thirds.
Yeah. It's amazing. Richard Nixon is famous for having launched the war on drugs in words, but in actions, he actually was quite progressive about drugs. He's far more than Obama.
Folks, if you're listening to Eugene Jarecki, David, and I, we're talking about the war on drugs. And if you've got a comment, you can reach us at 215-263-1003. That's right, 215-263-1003. We're talking to the award-winning director of The House I Live In, which will be broadcast tomorrow night on PBS in Philadelphia and across the country. What is the percentage of the war on drugs that's going to treatment today?
Of the 5%. It's a tiny, tiny portion. It has nothing to do with the kind of numbers that were at work with Nixon.
Yeah. I mean, when Nixon was in office, the standard treatment protocol for addiction was 28 days in a structured rehab. I dare say that there's very, very, very few people who could get themselves into a rehab for more than a couple days, let alone 28, if at all.
Today they get tangled in whether they have insurance or not. There are barely any programs out there. I was talking to a prison security chief in Oklahoma. He said something amazing to me. He said, look, he said, you know, here in Oklahoma, you can't get mental health or addiction services unless you're rich. So you're unlikely to ever see any of that until you come here to my facility, to my prison. He said, and my people, you have to understand, they're not trained in mental health services. We're not training them in that. But, he said, and he looked at me square in the eye, and he said, the number one provider of mental health services here in the state of Oklahoma is this prison.
Hmm. Jeez.
Yeah.
Crazy.
It is.
Well, it's crazy.
Yeah. And we've been led down this path by our politicians. Those folks that we put in office, those folks that we elect year after year after year, have enacted the laws that have brought us to the place where we are the most prisoned population in the world.
You know, it's funny. I was saying this to you before, Dean. You can't help but think of people around a big conference room table with a drink in their hand and some of them with cigarettes talking about how they're going to combat, you know, this war on drugs. You know, it's so just ironic and crazy and...
But it's interesting. I think part of what's important, because I sometimes imagine that conference room of evil people counting their money at other people's expense, but I think life probably doesn't happen as cartoonishly as that.
Right,
therefore,
right.
You need to figure out, well, how is it really working? And the interesting thing there is it works because it involves the activities of everyday people, not monsters. Primo Levi, the Holocaust scholar, said an amazing thing about this. He said, monsters are too few in number to be truly dangerous. The real danger is everyday people who acquiesce to systems of abuse without asking questions.
No, yeah, I totally agree with you. I mean, this system has been, you can see it. I mean, think about it. The prison, the people who work in the food industry, who provide food to prisons, the people who clean the facilities, all these things, they're just everyday people making a living.
And in a group, let's say you took that food service company, okay?
Yeah.
You walk in there for the day, and I've done a lot of this. I've spent a lot of time in the companies that service the prison system.
Okay.
You walk in there, and you've got, you know, a whole range of people. It's not that they're all good people or they're all bad people. You have one guy who's kind of a jerk, and he'd be doing that, whether he, you know, just a job, whatever. I'm phoning it in. Who cares what these guys eat? And there's another, like, there's another cook lady with a hairnet on who's, like, super committed.
Yeah.
She'll refer to the inmates as, like, these are my kids. You know, I'm feeding them. And she's literally thinking that she's making them with the same TLC that she's making for her own kids. So this system doesn't need to be rampant with ill-intentioned people. In fact, it's rampant with totally normal people with the full range of intentions.
No, that's why, as you pointed out,
them.
Right, that's why it's so dangerous, because you get everyone involved. Yeah, I agree with you.
I think the reason I point that out is that I made the movie. I mean, I'm friends with all the cops I was with.
Right.
I'm friends with all the jailers.
Sure.
I got to know a lot of people, and it's not that kind of like, I'm friends with people, but I actually plug my nose about what they do. I understand what they do. They're doing, in a country that has almost no jobs, they're doing jobs in one of our primary industries. So the question is not for them.
Right.
The question is at our leadership. How dare you run run a country you call a beacon of democracy and make a prison industrial system of mass incarceration one of your primary modes of breadwinning.
Right.
How yeah, actually,
you don't fix that. So you actually allow a situation where your population has an unchecked level of drug addiction that you have left untreated. Only the U.S. government has chosen to not treat the addiction of its people. Other countries that have robust treatment systems are dealing with addiction as a modern crisis.
And in fact, a lot of these jobs and a lot of these normal, quote unquote, people, the non-evil, non-monstered people, could be redirected into a treatment bent as opposed to an incarceration bent.
Right away. And treatment's not easy. No one should be out there going, well, that's a walk in the
park. No.
But it's a fraction the expenditure, and it actually bears positive results. The one thing we know is that the prison industrial system does not bear positive results in solving addiction. When you take someone who is poor and therefore self-medicating because they are having a crisis of meaning and they're struggling for their lives and they're living in places that don't give them a sense of safety and security, that very often leads to tremendous levels of self-medication. And, of course, if you're 13 or 14 years old and you don't have a father and you don't have a lot of structures in place in your broken community, which is, you know, part of the problem that this very greedy country has produced such a wealth gap, well, what you end up with is you're a young person. You make a wrong choice, like how many of us have, to dabble in something like marijuana or something. Well, you get a strike on your record from that, and you're never going to come back from that. That strike on your record is going to dog every job interview you ever have. It's going to be on that form you have to check the box on. And so right away, at 13 or 14 years of age, somebody's fate is being written. And the next time they try to get a job, they find they can't get it in the mainstream industry. So they turn to an underground economy, more drug dealing, and now they're around the drugs more. So all of us who have addictive tendencies, all of us, and I mean Americans, people in the modern world, are used to quick fixes. The iPhone is an addiction. Shopping is an addiction. Gambling is an addiction. Alcohol is an addiction.
Yep.
All of these addictions need to be thought of as health matters. Now, we ignored ours. One of the fascinating things about it is because we ignored the health crisis of addiction in this country, we have the highest demand in the world. That level of demand and the illegality of it is why the price stays where it stays, worth fighting for a country, for example, like Mexico. So when you look at Mexico and you think, well, they have a drug war too, no, that's our drug war. We are propagating the drug war in Mexico. That's just another side of our mistake, because by keeping it high, we've got the Mexicans scrambling to kill each other to service our addiction.
Right.
Yeah, we are the purchasers of the world's drug industry at the pace of about somewhere $10-15 billion a year, every year. Cha-ching. You know, I mean, it just goes on and on. Let's talk to Arnell from Camden, New Jersey. Good morning, Arnell, and welcome to Court Radio.
Good morning, man. I'm listening to you guys.
And well, is any of it new news to you, Arnell?
Listen, none of it is new news to me. If I could bring you two dudes up on the speed, the three law strike, you're talking to Arnell Drayton. Convicted felon, two gun, two drug, two assault from Camden, New Jersey. The only thing that law put in, you know, instilled in my mind was not to get in no more trouble because they're going to hang me. And that's retarded. That's retarded because I'm trying to survive in this world, so to speak. The only way I knew how at that point.
See, but Arnell, you're a case study. The system would hear you and say, good, the three-strike deterrent worked. It scared him out of more crime.
Okay, now I can respect that from the system. Know what else the system did? Or more or less know what I did instead of letting the system hang me? I got out of that prison. I looked at my situation. I started my own little home repair business. Then picked up another second job. I know this is the story of a lot of people that was in the trouble I was in. It come down to one thing, making a decision. I made a decision that I want to live, and I left the rest of the BS alone and just start living.
Well, that's a tackle. What you did, in essence, Arnell, is you tackled the addiction, and
exactly.
And then you decided to recover, and you're living. Unfortunately, as Eugene said, and as I know myself, addiction, and you're the success story, and I applaud you for that. But addiction is a very, very difficult disease to deal with, and unfortunately, a lot of folks, before they get to deal with it, end up as a part of our 25% of the world's prison population.
And I was in there with them.
And oh, what a world we would live in if we dealt with it as a disease as opposed to a crime.
Can I put this out there as a person, you know, again, freely, convicted of all these things, right? I watch our news today. You know how many nursing homes are being, like, patients that are in nursing homes? And I have a mother, 70-year-old mother, who happens to live, you know, in a place where someone tends to care for her as well. A lot of these people committing certain crimes don't even have a record. In the school system, in the, you know, nursing system, in the city hall system, whereas though you get a guy like me, can't even get a shot at getting, let's say, a job in a hospital because I might what? Look what my jacket said I used to do. It didn't say I wasn't used to working. It said I was, you know, doing certain things to make an income. If you give me an opportunity, like someone recently gave me a beautiful opportunity. I drive for transportation. I'm one of the best workers for my transportation job. Me and about, I'll say, 40 other convicted felons. Know why we're one of the best workers that do what we do? We know we can't make another mistake. We know we made a choice to start living. A lot of people in our country need to start looking at that, is all I'm saying. The ones with a jacket, the ones without a jacket, if you know what I mean.
Arnell, thanks for giving us a call at Court Radio, and have a great Sunday.
Can I ask what Arnell said?
Yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, you know, people will listen to him, and they'll think, well, this makes it complicated. I mean, I guess there is something to say for deterrence. I guess there is something to say for three strikes laws and stuff. And the answer is, well, yeah, sure. I mean, I can also say to you the way to get rid of mosquitoes in the world is to drop a complete bomb on all mosquitoes forever. But you'll learn right away that once you have a world without mosquitoes, a million other tragedies start to unfold where you discover what role the mosquito played on life on Earth. The reality is the ham-fisted, giant, sweeping dragnet of doing things like three strikes laws, sure, it can accidentally solve the problem of somebody like Arnell, but it's not designed to. It only happened with him because he was one of the tiny, tiny, tiny minority of people who found a way out of that horror in the way that he did. The majority disprove that. The majority demonstrate that those three strikes laws do not deter, that people continue to do the same crimes. Pew Research Center did a study that said, when you have about 300 people locked up for every 100,000 in a society, you are at a point where you successfully see crime deterrence numbers. So when your rate of arrest is 300 per 100,000, you're doing pretty good. When you start to head up toward 500, they watch that the effectiveness of law enforcement as a deterrent goes down, and you start to create more crime. So between 300 and 500, you're actually making more crime, not reducing crime, because you're over-incarcerating, you're treating the nonviolent as if they're violent, you're turning them into people who don't have lives, you're criminalizing people more than solving the problem. America has 740 people locked up per 100,000. We're way beyond Pew Research's danger zone of 500. In 10 inner cities in America, we lock up 4,000 African-Americans per 100,000. 4,000.
Jeez.
10 times what Pew Research says fosters crime.
When do we get college professors and scientists as politicians opposed to, what did you call them, the ham-fisted guys?
That's another system that's set up the way it's set up. As Eugene pointed out earlier, as soon as you get into office, your focus is on getting money to run again.
Right.
You're a victim of that. Even the best politician is somewhat of, you know, they can be a good politician and a nice person. They fall victim to that as well. They have no choice.
Look at the news story of the week about Obama. I saw it in USA Today. Obama traveling the country, juggling the need to govern with the need to fundraise.
Right, campaign.
Now, this guy's the president. He's supposed to be spending these 4 years like solving all the problems of the world, right?
Right, right.
Even he has to – do you realize that the president, it said, has to raise $150,000 a day every day that he's in office, not for his own reelection. He's not looking to be reelected. For the reelection of people in his party, because that's what he – functions to represent is a party.
Yeah, the whole system is really...
It's totally rigged. So I say it this way. What we need to do, what Americans, particularly your listeners, need to do is they need to, first of all, just think of the war on drugs going forward as public enemy number one. This is something that never should have happened, And we need to throw it away, just like we got past women not being allowed to vote, just like we got past slavery, just like we got past interning Japanese people after World War II. Like, we have done crimes in our history where we would look back and go, oh, my God, how did we get down that road?
Right.
Well, you're here again. We did it with Prohibition. For some reason, we decided to do it again here. And just as with Prohibition, it has to end. And the government has to move into a responsible role, like they have with alcohol, of taxing and regulating. Look what we do with alcohol. Alcohol is it's a controlled substance. It's illegal to sell to children. It's legal for grown-ups to consume. But they have to consume it responsibly. And if you go out in your car and you kill somebody and you've been and it's manslaughter, if you were drinking, it's going to aggravate the offense. Well, drugs should, like alcohol, be looked at that way. But instead, we take all of the drugs on the schedule of illegal drugs, none of which are as dangerous as alcohol, none of which at all have the track record of destruction of human health or human safety as alcohol, and we treat them far more severely.
Right.
Why?
Yeah, it's incredible. And it's so simple when you point it out, but, you know, not enough people are pointing
out. We fell for a lot of rhetoric. We fell for, like, you know, for example, I talked to this scholar at Columbia University in New York who studies drugs, and he administers drugs in tests to subjects to see the effect of methamphetamine, cocaine, heroin, all kinds of drugs. And he studies them religiously. And I said to him, you know, he pointed out something very interesting to me. He said, you know, a lot of times with drug use in this country, the government loves to point at the drugs as that's the problem in that community. He said, and really what that does is it tells a great lie, because the majority of people who will try this drug or that drug, meth, crack, heroin, will not become addicted to it. It's a particular handful who will, and they will become badly addicted in ways that can be fatal and terrible, and that's where the public health crisis emerges. He says, but the way they would have us think it, it's just the drugs are the problem overall. That way the government can turn a blind eye to all of the ways that it's failing the public in general.
Right.
So you come into an inner city where a kid has no community structure, no town hall, broken family, failing schools, not enough teachers, no textbooks, nothing motivational, and you say, and the cops are stopping and frisking these kids every 45 seconds, as in New York City, and destroying their identities, and then you say, oh, it's the drugs that are the problem.
Right.
Yeah. Blame the drugs.
You know, it's just sick. And so we will get past it, because the people of this country are against the drug war.
But the
it's
question,
only politicians and corporate actors who are into it.
The question is, how long? How long before we're more Portugal than we are America? Eugene Jarecki, award-winning director, Emmy winning director of The House I Live In. We really thank you for joining Court Radio this morning.
Great to be here.
Thank you so much.
This is you're a fine storyteller, Eugene, and this is a story that needs to be told, and as a result, God willing, changes will occur. Thank you for joining Court Radio, and it's my pleasure, and have a great Sunday, Eugene.
You guys too.
All right,
take care.
David, we're going to finish up the hour. We really got deep into the subject.
How can you not? It's so compelling. And thankfully, hopefully this movie will raise some more awareness. I mean, it obviously does.
At some point,
everybody needs to see it.
At really some point, we have to hit a critical mass where the momentum to move towards treatment and away from incarceration just steamrolls the whole incarceration kind of mentality.
And I have to say, Eugene is a very good spokesperson for, you know, getting the facts out.
Yeah,
I mean, he obviously knows this stuff like the back of his hand, and he sounds compelling. I like that.
Folks, you're never going to be able to think about this the same way. Listen tonight at 10 p.m. I'm sorry, tomorrow night at 10 p.m. on PBS for The House I Live In. Thanks for joining Court Radio this Sunday, and we will see you again next Sunday.
If your child suffered a birth injury, you know what matters. Getting proper medical care, counseling and assistance, knowing your rights, and getting just compensation to provide for your child's future matters. That's why your attorney matters. My Philly Lawyer is ready to fight relentlessly for you and your child. Call 215-227-2727. Choosing the right legal representation is critical to getting the compensation you deserve. My Philly Lawyer, when winning matters most.
If you've been injured, the road to recovery can seem long. At United Therapy Centers, we're here to help. Call us 877-510-7764. With leading-edge technology and our team approach, we provide the highest level of patient care with a pain management program developed just for you. If you've been injured, we can help. Call United Therapy Centers toll-free 877-510-7764. United Therapy Centers, get on the road to recovery.